Accession number 13670, Reel 4.
Colonel Jones, Reel 4.
And I was wakened in the morning being licked in the face by the farm dog. And here we found that we'd been squeezed out in our advance. Various other units were moving in on what was eventually the Falaise pocket. There were the Americans and the Canadians and other British Army divisions. So we were left there in a sort of backwater. And we had, in fact, almost a month's respite there. We stayed there after almost 2 months when we had been more or less continuously in contact with the enemy. So it wasn't until September the 18th that we came back into the war again. Everybody else had been galloping madly across France and into Belgium and onto the approach of Holland. And we were moved on September the 18th, nearly 280 miles, to a place called Kleiner Brogel, or Little Brogel, which is in the far northeast corner of Belgium, just short of the Dutch frontier. Although, again, we didn't know at the time, we were operating on the right flank of Operation Market Garden, which had been launched the day before. And our task was to clear and protect the right flank of the drive to back up the airborne drops at Eindhoven, Nijmegen and Arnhem. The countryside was dreadful. It was low-lying and damp at the best of times, but the Germans had interrupted deliberately the drainage system, so it was badly flooded. It was crossed by a number of canals. There were few roads, and most of those were metal, and they were raised on embankments. So the tanks were sitting ducks on the top of these embankments. They could only travel behind each other, one behind the other. If they attempted to get off the road, they became bogged down in the swampy ground. And furthermore, the troops that accompanied them, when they got off the road, encountered numerous mines. And for the first time, we encountered these shoe mines, the wooden mines that couldn't be detected with mine detectors. So progress was slow. During this period, my successor, Lieutenant Cope, was killed on a patrol. It was unfortunate. He went out with two men into a wooded area. They surprised two Germans who ran away. One of them, as he ran, flung one of these potato masher grenades, and a piece of it lodged in Lieutenant Cope's throat. And unfortunately, instead of one of the men staying with him to look after him while the other went for help, they both went to help, and by the time they got back, he'd bled to death. And within a day or two, we also lost Lieutenant Fryer. We were instructed to cross the Merz-Esco Canal. We kept it under observation for a long time, and we were pretty certain there was no enemy the other side, but again, they must have been experienced troops because they waited until the assault boats of Mr. Fryer's were almost across the other side when they opened fire and killed a lot of his platoon and took the rest of them prisoner. I'm glad to say that I did hear from Canadian sources a few years ago that Mr. Fryer did survived the war and came back. On the 20th, we entered Weert, which is just inside Holland. I can remember we advanced along the road and it was getting light, and there appeared to be a factory on our left. But as it got lighter, we realised it was one of the things which we have in this country now but hadn't then, one of these farms with chickens producing vast quantities of eggs. And I can remember saying to my batman, well, fry a dozen of these for breakfast, will you? And eventually, when we got into Wirt itself, we found that, as you probably know, the Germans had been collecting farm produce from the occupied territories and shipping it back either to feed them, the army, or the population. And there were, we captured 2 million eggs, which provided an egg apiece for everyone in the army. But the advance was slow, as I said, for the reason I described. And on the 27th, we were joined by a young Dutchman called Frank Neuerberg, who suddenly appeared. We were a bit suspicious seeing this civilian who spoke perfect English. And we were treating him with a certain amount of caution when the quartermaster, Billy Burke, came in and said, "Hello, Frank, what are you doing here?" He knew Frank because Frank's uncle had in fact commanded the 1st Battalion South Lancashire Regiment some years previously, and this was why Frank spoke such good English. And he'd made his way from The Hague and found us and offered his services as interpreter and stayed with us for the rest of the campaign. There were occasional amusing incidents. Sometime about now, we'd moved into a group of farm buildings on the heels of the Germans. People say, and it's quite true, you could always smell where the Germans had been. I don't know whether it was the rations or the cigars they smoked or what, but we were obviously very close behind them. And as we moved in, they did what they often did, that shelled the position, knowing that we were occupying it. And it was very brief, and I went round to see everybody was all right. Those who know the operations of battalion quarters realised that the people who always got the first brew of tea were the FOO, the artillery officer, because, of course, he had a Sherman tank and all the equipment. So I went through the doorway of this outbuilding, and there was the sort of motionless scene. In there, on the floor, there was a primer stove with a pan of water boiling on it. There was the FOO and his wireless operator and another gunner and the regimental sergeant major. And they were staring at something in the corner, and I looked, and there was a shell steaming faintly. It had come in, hit the door jamb, gone round the room a couple of times and landed in the corner without exploding. Again, although we didn't realise at the time, though we heard a day or two later, they'd withdrawn the remnants of the 1st Airborne from Arnhem. So on the 1st of October, we were moved forward rapidly and relieved part of the American 82nd Airborne east of Mook. And Mook's just about as far east as you can go in Holland. And we occupied a ridge overlooking the Reichsveld in Germany, just a few hundred yards from the German border. And behind us was this rather attractive village of Mook in a depression, a basin. And we were on this rather bleak hillside. There was a cold, bleak wind blowing, and it was drizzling. And as it got dark, we heard the caravans, etc., of brigade headquarters moving into Mook, and thought, how lucky they were having this pleasant accommodation and so on. And then, quite shortly after that, it was miles out in Germany, there was a great flash, and then a roar overhead, an enormous explosion in the village of Mook. And this was repeated several times. And after a few rounds, the big brigade IO got on to me and said, "Somebody's knocking hell out of us. What's it like up there?" And I said, "Oh, it's very quiet up here. Well, what do you think happening?" And I said, "Well, I think it's a very large caliber railway gun that they probably keep in a tunnel overnight, and they brought it out." He said, "Well, can't you do something about it?" I said, "No, it's a bit sort of beyond us. I'll give you a few compass bearings on it if you like." So we did that, but the shelling went on, and after a few more rounds we heard lots more creaking and revving up of engines, and it was brigade headquarters moving out of Mook. I had another mildly amusing episode too. I had to go to headquarters of part, I don't know whether it was the divisional headquarters or not, of the American 82nd Airborne. And the general commanding was sitting at a desk in his shirt sleeves with braces. It was quite the traditional sort of picture of an American high-ranking officer, facing some French windows which are open onto the garden of this rather pleasant house. And from time to time, American soldiers on these little folding airborne motorcycles would drive straight in from the garden into the room and sling a message onto the table. And the general would say to them, "Well, how are things, Hank?" And they'd reply, calling him by his Christian name. It was quite informal. And I remember, I think I caused quite a consternation by going in and delivering a traditional salute, which I think they thought was a bit over the top. But it was all very casual and democratic, I suppose. Anyway, they decided, the holding of the Arnhem Bridge having failed, that they would clear the Venlo Salient, which was just west of the Maas, particularly Overloon and Venray, in what was known as Operation Aintree. So we were given we'd operated with them before, but it was the 6th Guards Independent Tank Brigade that supported the division on this occasion. And the operation started with the 2nd East Yorks and the Suffolks, with the assistance of the Coldstream Guards in these Churchills, Captain Overloon. And the following day, which was the 13th, we cleared some woods in the area. It was not dissimilar to the area I've described before, except there were raised areas of sandy soil with clumps of coniferous trees growing in them, and between the area was low-lying and flooded, and there were very few tracks. One of the problems was that the woods on the ground bore no resemblance whatsoever to the woods marked on the map, so it was a bit difficult in working out operations and start lines and so on. But we cleared woods on the 13th and again on the 14th. And on the 16th, the first phase of Operation Aintree being over, we were directed against Venray itself, which was a fairly large town. And between Overloon and Venray, there was an obstacle called the Molen Beck. And this actually was nothing more really than a large drainage ditch. It was about 8 to 10 feet across and about 8 to 10 feet deep, with a few feet of water in the bottom. But The banks were very muddy. In fact, the whole area was muddy and flooded, and it was strewn with mines. But it was very difficult to get tanks across. They brought one of these tanks with a scissor bridge over, first of all, and that sort of sank with a gurgle, and they had to put another one on top of it. And then when they got the tanks the other side, the ground was so bad they couldn't move forward. So I went back some years later and looked at the officer. It seemed ridiculous that it held up a whole brigade for hours, but the other factor which we discovered was that the church tower in Venray was occupied by a lookout post of the Germans, and they could see every single thing we were doing from this, and so we were able to direct their gunfire and mortar fire on us. But eventually we got over this and moved into Venray. Other units had come in. I think the 2nd East York had taken part of it already. And as we arrived, we again were greeted by heavy shelling, which sounded very unpleasant in the narrow streets with tall buildings on either side. And we then moved rapidly through and debouched the other side. And we there lost one of our very brave officers called Ted Fenton, who was in charge of the anti-tank platoon. I think he was a bit sensitive of the fact that, if you remember, when B Company had been overrun in Chateau de Lalande, part of the problem was that they hadn't got the anti-tank guns up. I think he was very keen to make sure the anti-tank guns came forward rapidly. So he went forward to reconnoitre, and the Germans had at least one 75mm gun firing over open sights as our troops came out of the south of the town. And Ted Fenton was killed by one of these shots, and our troops actually captured this gun while it was still firing. We stayed in this position in Venray for some days, just over a week, I think. And again, there was one quite amusing incident there. There was a big hospital called St. Anna's, and the signal officer and I, Johnny Longland he was called, were delighted to find a room with a bed in it, or two beds in it. They say it was a hospital, and we thought, well, this is wonderful, being able to sleep in a bed for a night. Trouble was, we hadn't realised there was no roof on the building, so in the middle of the night it started raining heavily and we were soaked and had to move, but there we are. Anyway, on November the 4th, we were relieved by the Royal Ulster Rifles in 9 Brigade, if that strikes a chord with you.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I got that wrong. We relieved the Royal Ulster Rifles in 9 Brigade, east of Venray, but still not up to the Oostrum-smacked railway line. And the Germans were still holding that at a forward position between there and the Mars, which was a short distance to the east. And I can remember clearly on one occasion going forward with the second command and the CO to have a look at this position. By now, of course, the Germans on the defensive were using mines much more extensively than they had before, particularly anti-personnel mine. And we were moving forward when the second man said, very quietly, just a moment, just stand still, everyone. And we did. He said, look down. We all looked down. All of us were standing astride of these little wires that stick up from these anti-personnel mines. The whole area was covered. So we very cautiously crept back. At the same time, or a little later, Lieutenant Wright and Lieutenant Rennie were carrying out patrols into this area, and Lieutenant Wright lost a foot on one of these mines, and Lieutenant Rennie went out to rescue him, and he lost a foot as well, so the two had to be rescued. It was a particularly nasty experience. As you probably know, not only did they blow your foot off, but they shot pebbles and dirt and bits of shrapnel into your lower body as well. It was a very nasty weapon. And it wasn't until the 23rd that we realised the Germans were withdrawing, and we moved up to the river line of the Mars itself. And again, we had a rest period of a fortnight. When we moved forward, again, to occupy the river line, more or less permanently, for the winter period. The Mars was flooded, and we did a number of patrols by boat across the river to the other bank. Very peculiar there. You'd think that the Mars would be the boundary between Holland and Germany, but in fact there's a strip of land never more than 10 kilometres wide on the east of the Mars that's Dutch territory. So this was still, as it were, friendly territory. And one bitterly cold night, the Burgomaster von Well swam across the river to our side to bring information and, I suppose, to escape from the Germans. On the 1st of January, the Germans launched an attack on Wonsum, which was about in our centre of our position, and the casualties on both sides were about equal. And we sent out patrols to make sure that the Germans had withdrawn. But when they came to a wood just south of Wonsum, it was again marked on the map just as point 14.2, they came under fire. A couple of small-scale attacks were launched, and it was realised that the enemy were there in greater strength than we'd thought, and also, of course, they were able to call on artillery fire from the other side of the river. So they launched a full-scale attack, and for the first time we were able to use Kangaroos. They were the armoured tracked vehicles. Really, I think they were just tank chassis with the top taken off, but they carried the troops up to the actual debussing point where they could go straight into the attack. There was a bit of confusion there. They hadn't been used very much before, and one problem they found, which they rectified, was that the Kangaroos drove up, let the troops off, and then swung round, and often on this occasion set off a mine which injured the troops. They got over that one subsequently. And George Wilson, who had been one of our original D-Day officers and had, I think, been wounded and come back again, was again wounded there and taken prisoner, but released at the end of the war. So we stayed on the banks of the Mars. It was cold. Even the Dutch admit it was a particularly bad winter, and we spent time there. What happened was they would have two battalions forward and one in rest area and interchange them, and we tried to do the same as much as possible to keep one company forward and another back, but it was very unpleasant conditions. Damp, cold, and that was where we started having a few cases of trench feet. And we were there until February the 6th, when the 4th, 5th Royal Scots Fusiliers from 52 Div relieved us, and we went back and had again a long rest period until the 25th, when we relieved the 6th KOSB of the 15th Scottish Division near Gouk in Germany itself. It seemed a long way to go there. We went up the banks of the Maas to Nijmegen, crossed there and came back down the other bank of the Maas until we reached Gouk. And we seemed to go a very long way, but we realised when we look at the map that as the crow flies, we're only about 10 miles from where we'd been guarding the river Maas all winter. And we started clearing, or continued clearing, other divisions had been on it, the area between the Maas and the Rhine. And our first task was to clear some woodland area leading up to the Udem-Wies road. And the 2nd East Yorks were on our right flank, and they had, as you perhaps heard from Nigel Roebuck, a very rough time. They captured a bridge over the Molen Fluth, where this Udem-Wies road crossed it, and they had a very difficult time holding on to it. The Germans almost fanatically tried to recapture it. And of course, you must remember that the Germans were now fighting on their own territory, so that they were fighting fanatically for the country. And what we realised later was, of course, they were trying to get possession of this bridge so as to allow their troops who were defending the Maas to withdraw. In fact, eventually it turned out to our advantage, because had the troops withdrawn to the other side of the Rhine crossing would have been much more difficult. But in fact, a lot of the German troops were either killed or taken prisoner in that area between the Maas and the Rhine, and so subsequently the Rhine crossing became much easier. But we didn't see that at the time. I can remember one aspect of this clearance of ours on the left of the East Yorks in this area. The Germans had prepared this wood. They'd blocked all the tracks through the wood. They got them covered with machine guns, they got snipers up in the trees, and they were using their Panzerwerfers, the German type of bazooka, very effectively against the tanks. The CO decided he'd go forward with me, and we went right forward the troops to the edge of this wood where there's a corduroy road leading into it. The Germans obviously realised that we were going to attack this, and I can remember standing with my back against the CO's carrier, waiting for our troops to come forward, and seeing the German shells go over. It's rather like if you're hitting a golf ball and you're directly behind it, you can see where it goes. So you could see these shells coming over and landing where our troops were advancing. And then they shortened the reins and started dropping them on this corduroy road that led into the wood. And our troops advanced, and they had a very rough time in this wood. The snipers were obviously looking for